crimes that he committed until he is punished.
Punished.
It's not simply about, you know, driving him out of the Iranian territory any longer.
It's about punishing him.
It's somebody who is a criminal has to be punished.
Exactly.
For the damage they have done to other innocent human beings. Okay?
And Imam Khomeini is uncompromising
now,
in that.
Now, imagine saying this, and you have a lot of people around you being like, well, no, this
well,
is...
Well, yeah.
Right?
Right.
And, of course, this is going to repel people. Of course, this is going to make some people feel like, you know, why? Let's just kick him out of the country, whatever. Okay? Which is what they were talking about.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, sure.
So, the point is that you have this unjust, unfair, imposed war.
Sure.
And it's not just Saddam. It's like Saddam attack. Well, Saddam was the instrument with which all these nations united
attacked.
Kill the Islamic revolution.
Yes. And this was unprecedented because, as you and I know at the time, the Soviet Union
and the Americans
were at first, they had common ground all of a sudden.
Right. They had the same language. Just like Israel and
Saudi
Arabia
have the same language now. They had the same language at the time to get rid of Imam Khomeini out of Iran. So
not only Imam, to get rid of the Islamic Revolution.
Revolution.
Because all their battle, all their unjust and evil schemes and plans and profits that they were making and domination that they had, especially in this strategically important area of the Middle East, West Asia, was being threatened.
Sure.
Okay? Mm. So, the point is that that's when you see this hardcore personality coming through.
Sure.
Okay? Mm-hmm. You have a hardcore personality like him. You have this personality who is not simply trying to, compromise with an evil criminal, mind in terms of, or an actor like Saddam or his supporters or the Zionists or whoever it is.
Sure.
Even though a lot of people are saying, there was that famous thing during the war, a lot of people who know the history of the war, where you had the president who was then, who then fled in wearing women's clothes, Benisad.
Right.
He basically said, we have to have a strategy where we give territory and we win time.
Uh-huh.
Which, militarily is just...
It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Yes.
Because the whole point is territory.
Yes.
The point is to get back territory in the shortest time.
Shortest possible time.
Right. So a complete, whatever you want to call it, amateur when it comes to military affairs.
Sure.
And, whatever. So Imam at that time is completely standing against that person who and then, that was the conflict that they got into because he was saying, I have the people's votes and... you don't need to tell me what to do. I know what to do, blah, blah, blah. In the end, Imam's like, you're not worthy of the presidency.
Yes.
And the parliament, impeached him.
Oh, impeached him, right.
And he then he went into the arms of the Munafiqin, of the terrorist cult.
Yes.
Around, those... That,
so
that
he
lady
was
and
really
that
exposed for what he was.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he ended up shaving his ridiculous little mustache.
Yes.
Putting on women's clothing and fleeing to Paris.
Oh, right.
Right?
Sure.
So this is the deal. Mm-hmm. And basically what you see is that Imam, from the very beginning of the war, is taking a very hardcore strategic view of this.
Right.
He's not only looking at the daily battles and this kind of short term, well, let's see what we can do here, then let's see what happens afterwards.
Yeah.
He knows from the very beginning how this thing is going to have to end up.
Sure.
Strategically, historically.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay?
Yes.
So, forget about those things that are happening internally. You have insurgency being started in Kurdistan by Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
This is before
the war actually started.
It's actually 2 years before that, where you have Shahid Chamran going in and the local people joining together with the Revolutionary Guard and, defeating the Saddam-backed Kurdish terrorists. You have the military coups that are being attempted in Iran.
Yes.
The Nojeh coup, where you have former officers being paid by the Americans to, conduct a coup. You have, disturbances in different parts of the country.
Of course.
So there's a million things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the war. And here is an 80-year-old man, and he's managing it.
Yes, he's managing it.
Right?
This is what you call faith and trust in God.
Right. And he's managing it not in the sense of, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Saddam, well, I will, if you don't do this, I'll chop your head off.
No, no. I mean, it's not like he's got detailed plans and charts all in front of him. He's a man who's...
He's managing it based on certain principles.
Principles.
Because he knows that these principles, which are from God...
God.
Will get you the result.
The result.
The most important being that you, as a leader, are not scared, do not have fear.
Fear.
You trust Allah's, you know, power. Over everything else,
mm-hmm.
and you don't consider yourself anything.
Exactly.
In the face of God.
Exactly.
And he has that famous line. I will never forget that line,
mm-hmm.
where you know, the soldiers are there in Jamaran. You know those films, which
yes,
is
yes.
like just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know the soldiers are coming to see him before they go to the front.
Sure.
In Jamaran.
Yes.
And he's holding a speech. You know those Imam
yeah.
speeches.
It's
yes. like,
yeah.
And he says to them, he says, "You're not my soldiers," because
no.
I think they were chanting something, "Oh, we are your soldiers," or something like that.
No, he said, "You're
he
not."
He said,
my
"You're not my soldiers,
soldiers
and I'm not your soldier. We are all God's soldiers."
Soldiers. And you do not belong to your parents; you belong to the Imam.
Okay, so this is the things that. This is the kind of leadership you require in these times, okay?
Yes.
There's many examples.
Mm.
You know, they attack, there's problems. He gets rid of them, because remember, the president is the commander-in-chief.
Chief.
So he gets rid of the commander-in-chief. He says, you're no good for this.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
He insists on the Revolutionary Guards being established
sure.
as a revolutionary military force. He insists on the besieged force being established, and he says we need an army of 20 million.
That's right, yes.
Okay.
Where have you reminded me? Yes,
he says we
right.
need an
yeah.
army of
20 million. Yes, and there was that famous poster with one guy holding up that banner of La ilaha illallah, and you have all these multitudes behind him.
Right,
exactly. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So he doesn't dissolve the army.
No. He actually wants to...
Listen, this is a big move
yeah,
by
yeah.
Imam.
Yeah.
It's a super hardcore, you know,
yeah.
move.
Move.
Because all these left-wing, you know, munafiqeen, all these, you know, radical groups
they
are
want
saying,
to disband the
let's
army.
Get rid of the Shah's
army.
This is the
that.
Shah's army. Mm. We will be the army.
Yeah.
And Imam's like, no, these are good guys.
These are good guys.
These guys, it's not their fault.
No.
They were in the army. They were serving their nation. They were defending their country.
Country.
Honorable men.
Yeah.
Most of them religious in
yeah.
their private lives.
Sure.
You know. That we have to keep them. Not
keep
only
them.
Do we have to keep them, we honor them.
Honor them.
They themselves know what to do. They don't need American advisors.
Yes.
They know themselves what they have to do.
Yeah.
They are better than the American advisors. They know how to defend their country better than foreigners.
Yes.
So he keeps the army. He establishes the Revolutionary Guard. He establishes
Basij.
He gets rid of the...
yeah.
He gets. I mean, that getting rid of Bani Sa'd was just brilliant.
Brilliant.
You know?
Yes, it was.
He's like, dude, you're out of here. Okay?
Yeah.
He's dealing with the coups. He's dealing with insurrections. Okay.
Yeah. And the other fact that, of course, you know, right at the outset as well, that many of those who masterminded the revolution as well, who later on became the government, they were assassinated by those very...
Exactly. We had the big...
And the Americans were thinking, yeah, we're onto the big one here because...
Remember,
about 72
this is actually,
of them,
you reminded me
yeah.
of a very important
yeah.
episode.
Yeah.
All of this, we're telling these episodes and these... So people know the history.
Yeah.
So they understand the personality of this person. You know,
sure.
you have this thing of Imam and, you know, in the West especially, people don't know his real personality.
Yeah.
So the first person that they kill after the revolution is who? Is Shahid Mutahhari.
Shahid Mutahhari, yes.
God bless his great soul.
Yes.
Okay? The first person they kill is Shahid Mutahhari, who's one of the leaders, the clerical leaders, who's a smart person.
Yes.
There's a famous story where you have the leaders of the Munafiqeen cult coming to... see Imam.
Yes.
And they have a camera with them.
Mm.
And it's clear what they want is they want to take a picture with Imam and then go around the world saying, oh, Imam has given us the approval that he's with us.
Sure.
And Imam, since before the revolution, had declared them to be non-Muslims.
Yes.
And giving money to them is haram as
yes.
As homes because yes. people had asked them.
Sure.
So they make it in front of the door of Imam's room with the camera. This is how far they are able to get.
Mm.
And Shahid Mutahhari happens to be there. And he says, what? You want to take this camera? no, Imam doesn't want you to take a picture. They're like, no, no, no. And you know, the whole Iranian Eastern kind of taught off. And no, halal, okay, so it doesn't matter. So let us take it in, blah, blah. You know what Shahid Motahhari does? He takes the camera and he smashes it.
Fantastic.
Right there. He says, I will not let you take a picture with Imam. You see? Another, you know, this is what you do for truth.
Truth.
They are trying to, you see, this is the way munafiq
and
people who are hypocrites and people who don't really believe the truth but have to live with the fact that there are people who actually stand up for truth and that they can't just openly, they try to do it through, you know, indirect and sneaky ways.
The sneaky ways.
And then a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, a person like Imam Khomeini, a person like Shahid Motahhari, when they stand up to them and actually break the camera, which is the tool for them to want to do their nifaq and want to do their, you know, propaganda, well, obviously they're going to cause enemies. And what do? They kill him.
Yes.
And what a great shahadat that is.
Yes.
To be killed by the enemies of truth.
Exactly.
Right? So, the first person they kill is Shahid Motahhari, and you have the funeral for Shahid Motahhari. This is 2 months after the revolution. I'm talking about the personality of Imam.
Yes.
Remember, didn't cry when his son was killed in Najaf.
No.
Everybody who was there in Najaf said Imam did not cry at the ceremonies for his son.
Sorry.
Didn't cry when he arrived. Didn't cry at the... No, nothing.
Nothing.
How do you feel? Nothing.
Hech.
He's crying at Shahid Motahhari's funeral.
That's right.
Okay?
Yes, I remember
the only person funeral that he cried at was Shahid Motahhari's.
Yes.
Yes? Why would he do that? Because he is a person who is embodiment of this polarization. He's the one that wrote the book about the polarization
of Imam Ali.
Right?
Yes.
I'm not saying this is the only reason. I'm saying Imam knows who Shahid Motahhari
is. That's why he
Imam knows, you know, who's been martyred.
Martyred.
He's crying on the one hand because he's happy for him that he's martyred.
Martyred.
And that he got to his goal.
Cool.
Right? And on the other hand, he's just thinking about, you know, this humanity. These are the people they kill. The way they kill our mullah, the way they kill all the good ones.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So Imam is crying at Shahid Motahhari's funeral.
Mm.
And the only other time he cried, that we saw him cry, was during Ashura and during Muharram.
That's right.
The ceremonies.
Yes.
Okay, we didn't see him cry anymore.
No.
And what does he say at Shahid Motahhari's funeral? This is important.
He said, "This is my son."
Besides those things.
Yes.
You know what he said? He says, killing us is not going to stop the revolution.
Ah, yes. Excellent.
This revolution is dependent on nobody.
Nobody.
Even if I am killed,
yes, even if I am killed.
Even if I am killed, the revolution
will
continue.
The revolution.
And just a note for those gentlemen who all these years insist that if they are not around, then the revolution will stray.
No, that's not the case.
Yes. Imam said, even if I'm not
there,
the revolution will continue.
Because
it's not about
personalities.
It's about Islam. It's about Haq.
Haq.
It's about people standing up for Haq,
which
the people have.
Yes.
Okay?
And there's always somebody else in the wings.
So, they're thinking, oh, we got one of the main dudes.
Yeah.
Then they go kill the 72.
The usual,
you know,
insane type thing.
They kill Shahid Beheshti and the 72 members of the Islamic Republican Party.
Party, yes.
Which is considered the elites and the top management of the revolution.
The masterminds of the revolution.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And thinking, well, that's it.
That's it.
It's
we've
all
done it.
Well, it's not.
No. It didn't do anything.
That's it. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So, the point is, so we have all this stuff going on. We've got the war then going on, and he being a decisive commander.
Sure.
He's saying, for example, he's saying this city has to be liberated.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
This city, that city, this battle. And then Khorramshahr, which was the main city that the Iraqis had held for years,
yes,
is liberated.
Yes.
Through the, you know, this ongoing struggle. The revolutionary forces, the Islamic forces, the Islamic Republican forces are able to, the Iranian forces are able to liberate Khorramshahr. And what does Imam say? God liberated Khorramshahr. Right?
It's a totally different world.
Right?
Yep.
Doesn't mean that people didn't struggle.
No, no.
Doesn't mean that he's not...
But the victory is attributed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Victory and defeat and everything is in God's hands.
Hands.
If you won, don't get arrogant.
Don't get arrogant.
If you won the victory, don't get arrogant.
Arrogant. This is a blessing from Allah.
When they were using chemical weapons, he forbade the use of chemical weapons against the Iraqis.
Yes.
People were saying, well, what does that mean? And, you know, we can respond in kind in Islam, and it's not a problem. And then he's like, nope.
No,
we will not use chemical. This nation, which is under the banner of Islam, will not use chemical weapons against other Muslims.
Because this is principle. This is truth.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing that you were mentioning before we came on air was the fact that, you know, the Imam gave this very powerful command to sink an American ship.
Well, when the Americans entered the Persian Gulf, under the guise of protecting, shipping lanes.
Oil tankers, yeah.
The first thing he said is, you know, sink one of them.
Sink one of them.
And, well, they didn't, for various reasons.
Yes.
And the justification for not doing it was, well, the Americans are going to enter the war.
Yeah, but they entered it anyway.
And then they entered it anyways.
Yeah.
So
if they had listened to the Imam.
So if they just listened to the Imam.
They wouldn't have entered the war.
I'm not saying the Americans wouldn't have entered it, but, well, if they're going to enter it anyways, you might as well, you know, give them a little warning, a little deterrence, as they say.
A little deterrence.
You know, a little, you know, thought along the way, if you want to get involved, things are going to happen.
Mm.
And so this is the deal. When you have a hardcore person like Imam, who's not scared, he has to go back. It goes back to being not scared. How is it that you're not scared? Again, for me, this is theoretical because I'm scared all the time.
Okay.
So what I'm saying, it's not that I'm not claiming that I have this mastered in some way.
Mm.
Why is Imam not scared? And remember his famous quote. He swears by, you know, the unity and oneness of Allah, that I have never been scared of anyone except for Allah. Remember, this is a big.
No, this is big. This is very important.
It's big.
That's just like our Imams.
Right. It's big.
It's big.
It's not a small statement.
No.
Okay?
No.
And why isn't he scared? It's because he has complete trust in Allah.
Of course.
I mean, it sounds
Allah
simple.
Allah will do things.
It sounds simple.
Which is beyond human imagination.
It sounds simple, right?
Yes, it does. But it's deep. Things happen, which we can't imagine.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, what would have been the consequences if you'd actually sunk an American ship?
Well, I would argue minimum is the Americans would think twice.
Think twice, yes. Or would have let the Soviets deal with the problem.
Well, all I'm saying is that, you know, your action has an effect on things.
Of course they do.
Okay? So, let's say they had done that.
Yeah.
Maybe, I'm not saying, you know, things would have been greatly different.
Sure.
It's the principle of it.
Mm.
If you're going to enter our territory, if you're going to enter our area...
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to pay for it.
You're going to have to pay for it.
Right? If you want to, go ahead, but you're going to have to pay for it.
Exactly.
Okay? So this is the deal. Mm. This is what a real... You see, we have this thing in the West where it's defense is a necessary evil.
Yes.
This is the way they justify it in the West.
Yes, that's right.
Especially in the Christian tradition.
Yes.
They say it's a defending yourself militarily is not evil. No. It's good.
It's good.
It's not a necessary evil.
No.
It's good. It's just.
That's what you have to do. Naturally,
it's just. It's the embodiment of justice. It's the embodiment of righteousness.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a necessary evil to defend yourself.
Sure.
Yes, going to war, getting killed, killing, you know, maiming.
Yeah.
These are not pleasant things to do.
Sure.
And I don't mean pleasant in the... If you're fighting, you know, against shaitan, it's actually quite pleasant.
It is.
Okay? It's not a... You know what I mean?
It's not a part-time hobby.
It's pleasant in the sense that you're doing a righteous act. It's like, you know, you're doing something good.
Yes.
So it shouldn't cause you trouble. And by the way, can I just add something? This came to my mind right now.
Please.
Notice that how in Iran, we don't have the psychological problems among people who go to war as you have in all other countries.
Yes, that's a very good point. I mean,
soldiers don't commit suicide.
Suicide when they come back.
I'm not saying people aren't shell-shocked, some of them.
No, of course they do.
This
suffer.
Is a natural physical reaction to some of the things.
The traumas
but we
of
don't
war.
Have that... thing of, you know, veterans returning and becoming, you know, heroin addicts.
Yes,
we don't
psychopaths.
Have, you know, the more amount of people, you know, Vietnam veterans killing themselves from suicide than actually died in Vietnam. You know, we don't have that stuff.
No.
Why? Because in our view, which is the view of Islam, which is the Islam of Ahlul Bayt, going to war is not a bad thing.
It's a good thing.
Especially if it's defending.
Yeah.
Of course, we have to also mention as the main point, which is that all these wars that the West is doing is, you know, unjust offensive attacks against innocent people.
Exactly.
So obviously the soldiers are going to get confused and want to kill themselves after they've killed innocent people.
Exactly.
Okay? They're human beings.
That's the consequences of killing innocent
the
people.
Whole, you see, it's crazy. The whole military structure in the West tries to somehow create soldiers that will be immune to the effects of killing innocent people.
Yes.
This is the craziness they've reached.
Yes. But it doesn't work. It
doesn't work. You're dealing with human beings. There's a you know, you can't change human nature.
No, you can't.
Human nature, however you are, wherever you come from, whether it's Alabama or you know, whether it's Iran or wherever, you know, human nature is repulsed by killing innocent other human beings.
It is.
But it is not repulsed by defending against an unjust attack.
Exactly.
It considers it honorable. It considers it dignified. It considers it to be heroic.
Sure.
It considers dying on that way to be heroic. That's why you see that in Britain, because, you know, we like to complain about Britain.
Yeah,
but when the British were defending themselves against the Germans' attack.
That's right. They called it their finest hour.
Because it was their finest hour. Because Germans were attacking them, you know, unjustified, you know, in the context of these people fighting each other,
sure.
You know. And so people stood up, and Churchill came and said, we will, you know, what was that?
We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them on the fields.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is your natural right as a human being to defend yourself.
Absolutely.
If you're being attacked by another nation.
Sure.
Unjustly.
Yeah, sure.
So we get it. Mm. The West gets defense.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
But we don't have these problems in Iran with our soldiers and the people who went to the war. And we don't have the problems of the soldiers integrating back into society. And we don't have the problems of the families and the widows and the orphans that are that are left over. This is a natural part of human life. When you get attacked, you defend, and those who did it are the greatest heroes.
And the other thing that has to be mentioned,
and this is the path. This is the path of the imams, and this is something that a leader like Imam Khomeini understands.
Yes.
And that's why he said that famous sentence. Again, we're going back to this great, immense, intense personality.
Mm.
He says, the war is a great blessing.
Exactly. Because the other great blessing out of that is also martyrdom. Because martyrdom is a great victory, isn't it?
Listen. Mm. It doesn't... People can't wrap their heads around this.
Mm.
I'm talking about religious people.
Sure.
I'm talking about people who are, you know, in favor of the revolution.
Sure.
Imam says, because we're so indoctrinated by this Western thinking of war as a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then Imam says, it's a great blessing. The war is a great blessing.
Blessing.
The doors of heaven are opened up, go.
Mm.
And they went.
They went, yes.
And they went. And we're still here.
I know, pity.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yes.
And people who weren't there at that time, they don't understand.
No. They don't know what that meant.
Right.
Yeah, I think basically we're at the end of this particular session in terms of what we were discussing in polarization, you know, with the theme during the war. But of course, you know, this is something that even carries on beyond that.
Right.
And it is, there's no doubt, there is, it's an emotional topic, because really, I mean, when we stand up for truth and we really go according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt and understand the teachings of the Quran. And of course, you know, when God says that, you know, if you fight for Allah's cause, you die for Allah's cause, then death is not applicable in this situation. You're living.
You're not. The martyrs are not dead.
They're not dead.
They live and they're being sustained by their God.
They're sustained by their God. And that's what Imam Khomeini re-inculcated back into the Muslim Ummah. This idea that it's not only a great thing to defend your country and to defend your values and to defend your principles, but even if you're killed along the way,
you're a martyr.
You're a martyr. You're somebody of great status.
Right. Your status, your existential state is, you know, raised to that. And it has to do with the fact that you are showing and manifesting your complete obedience and submission to the will of God.
God.
Okay? And it's not that kind of browbeating submission, because people have this idea, and in the West we have this image of God as this kind of browbeating.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
It's ridiculous.
The submission is love.
Love.
It's becoming one with your God.
God.
It's, you know, letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
It's entering that paradise which is God Himself.
Exactly.
You understand?
Exactly.
God Himself, you know, paradise is God Himself. It's
you
know, being in the present. There are different stages of paradise.
Of course.
I'm not
of course.
Technically speaking.
Yes.
But what it is really what we're talking about is God Himself.
God Himself.
And when you feel that love, and you know, that's the highest level, because you know this is the goal. You're trying to feel that connection with Allah, the love, and that's what we talk about submission. We're not talking about submission as a slave submitting
in the
you know, deep south of the, you know, antebellum, you know.
No, we're not talking about that. This is,
you know, it's not that submission. It's a
pure complete, love.
Yeah, it's a complete letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
And complete trust and giving it over to Allah.
Dr. Matty Traube, on that note, thank you very much indeed for your contribution on The Man Who Changed the World. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
The Light. Cockatoos in Sydney suburbs have learned a new way to scavenge for food, opening wheelie bins with their beaks and claws. Australian researchers have found out that the parrot family birds are learning the ability from one another. Moreover, the scientists have discovered that cockatoos in different neighborhoods have distinct styles and approaches to pry open the bins. Although the birds opening bin lids seems to be a simple action, it shows a more complex behavior pattern that proves animals can learn, share, and develop subcultures. In some rural areas, online education during the pandemic seems a challenge as students do not have access to smartphones. In the Indian state of Jharkhand, teachers have come up with an innovative idea to tackle the problem. Turning walls of houses into blackboards is the solution. Under this circumstance, students can learn in the open air while maintaining social distancing. Teachers use loudspeakers to manage the classrooms. Parents welcomed the idea as most of them could not afford a smartphone and a fine internet connection. They also built platforms for students to sit on while attending classes. There is a famous quote, "One should always try to turn every disaster into an opportunity." A Swiss hiker with Parkinson's disease has put that saying into practice by hiking more than 1,100 kilometers across the Alps. Yves Aubusson, suffering from the disease for more than 16 years, completed the challenge in less than 100 days last year. During his journey, he scaled high-altitude peaks and crossed nearly 100 mountain passes. Aubusson says his first goal was to inspire fellow patients to be active even if they are gravely affected by the incurable disease. But he says his major motivation was to raise awareness of the debilitating neurological illness, which is little known.
What motivated me to do this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge. Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Luriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness record adjudicators. Luriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Laureano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. And but I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Laureano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year. In the U.S., creative designers are trying to raise awareness about the environmental issues in a fun and playful way. A climate change-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy inefficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artist, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curved hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the inverted dome. The viewing area of the inverted dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a 5-year construction process in the city's Lingang district.
French artist has created a huge cardboard installation in the shape of a hanging bridge. The artwork is 18 meters in length and hovers above Rome's Tiber River with the help of three gigantic helium-filled balloons. Olivier, who created the work, was inspired by famous Italian Renaissance architect and sculptor Michelangelo. The Italian master had been tasked with the constructing a bridge on Tiber to connect the gardens of the Villa Farnesina to the Farnese Palace. However, he died before he could complete the venture. Now Michelangelo's mission has been accomplished centuries after his demise by one of his admirers.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform three surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. A Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely it's against each other. But in the same time, we think it's in the digital and the nature is quite easy to merge.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind. Animals have been providing protection and service to people since time immemorial. They have not only been the source of food like meat, butter and milk, but also served humans by eating plants toxic to them. Authorities in New York City have taken 24 goats from a nearby farm to the Riverside Park in Manhattan to munch on invasive weeds. They say it's an environmentally friendly win-win for the species removal at the park. The goats get to feast on overgrown bush, and Riverside Park Conservancy doesn't have to dump harsh chemicals on weeds. Park officials say it's both healthy for the goats and good for the environment.
As part of our woodland restoration initiative, 2 years ago, we unleashed a very hungry group of goats into a stretch of the park that had been overrun with invasive plants. And wow, did they exceed expectations. We called it Gotham because we put the goat in Gotham. They chowed down on Japanese knotweed. They noshed on porcelain berry. They snacked on multiflora rose. They easily traversed the hard-to-reach terrain behind me and gulped down poison ivy without even giving it a second thought. Since goats are naturally effective weed whackers, putting them to work in Gotham is like treating them to an all-you-can-eat buffet It's healthy for the goats, and it's good for the environment. That's farm to table.
People visiting the goats at the zoo say these animals are emotionally intelligent and connect with people. Goats are an ingenious approach to weed removal, eating species dangerous to humans like poison ivy. Of the 24 goats, 5 will call Riverside Park its home through the end of August. For some others, the public can vote to determine which goat will be crowned the greatest of all time. The winner will be announced by the end of the summer.
Singapore unveils one of the world's biggest floating solar panel farms in a bid for quadrupling its solar energy production by 2025. The farm is as big as 45 football fields. It includes 122,000 solar panels. The panels are designed to last for 25 years, and drones will be used to assist with maintenance. The farm is located on a reservoir in western Singapore and will generate enough electricity to power its 5 water treatment plants. It puts Singapore among the few countries in the world with a water treatment system fully powered by green energy. The farm can reduce Singapore's carbon emissions by 32,000 tons annually. Floating solar panels perform up to 15% better than conventional rooftop panels. That's because of the cooling effect of water and that shading from other buildings does not affect them. Singapore is currently developing 4 other floating solar panel projects. Maybe kittens are considered the cutest baby animals by many of us, but just wait to see this baby hippo, which was born during a full moon. The male calf was born in a Mexican zoo last month. He weighs 30 kilos upon birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So we've entered into a new phase of media censorship. The Western media has a long track record of actually censoring the voice of the revolution, the voice of Iran, the voice of the Islamic Republic, the voice of people anywhere, everywhere, who speak out against the system anyway. But now we've actually entered a phase where they've seized the websites of Press TV and Al Masira and Al Alam and other such channels out there. Now, this is a little bit strange. This actually shows us that the enemy is more on edge, it seems, than ever was before. The election of Sayyid Raisi may have a big part to play in this. I'd like to get your opening thoughts on this entire thing. I think Sheikh Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is nothing new, like you pointed out in your opening statement. When we look at the track record of the Western hegemonic governments and their affiliated apparatus, right? Even, you know, I would go to a point where United Nations and other so-called international organizations, they're part of that whole strategy and that whole plan, they have been silencing the word of logic, the word of rationality, the word of tolerance, the word of exposing the evil and standing up and resisting against the evil. This is nothing new. It has been going on throughout the history, even before this electronic media existed, right? If you look at the history, back in the day too, they would silence people from talking about and bringing up the realities of this world, right? So this is nothing new. Now, why is it happening now? Again, like you pointed out, I think the enemy, you know, they've realized that they're losing on the propagation and propaganda field as well. For instance, one of the examples, just to elaborate on this point, you look at the anti-Israel sentiment in the entire world, right? Especially the Western countries, right, where they praised back in the day, they praised the Zionist regime and, you know, in the name of human rights and so on and so forth, and rights for Jewish people and so on and so forth. Now, if you go in and talk to those people, because I've been in touch, right? 10, 15 years ago, the anti-Israel sentiment was very insignificant 15 years ago.
And it was limited to kind of clusters of very activist groups, and Muslims, some
and,
Muslims.
And non-Muslims too. It was very, very contained, right? It was not the mainstream narrative. Now, fast forwarding, especially after the social media and, you know, the officers of the software that are out there, the way they have raised the information level and the facts that they have presented and the logical discourses that they have presented, it has compelled many people out there, especially in the West. I keep saying West because I know in America, you know, when I used to read anytime there's a news report about Palestine or Israel in one of the mainstream news outlets, I used to read comments. You know, I think you all do every once in a while, you know, just to see what's going on, how are people. Well, back in the day, 15 years ago maybe, you would hardly find maybe one or two people exposing the crimes of the Zionist regime, right? Most of the people, they were, like I pointed out, they were supportive in one way or the other. But now if you go on any of these news, now the news channels have to delete those comments.
Yeah, often they'll say comments are not allowed.
Right? Why are they doing it? Because they're losing on that battlefield as well, and it has changed the perception of the people of the world, the general masses of the world.
I'm going to want to come back to this, but Sayyid Mahdi, so Sheikh Ali pointed out how previously, if you go 10, 15 years back, the negative sentiments towards Israel were lower than they are today. And we talked about how the activists and those small clusters of groups that existed back then who were pro-Palestine, they were contained back then, and now it's not so contained. Now, my question to you is, these groups obviously did a lot of propagation, they did lots of work, they created posters, they held up banners, they went to the protests and all those kinds of things. To what extent do you feel that they have had an impact on the wider audiences out there?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's a very good point, it's a very solid point that even a small group of people, if they are dedicated, if they remain steadfast, if they believe in their cause and their cause is a just cause, it might take a little bit of time, but surely they will overcome and they will be victorious even upon a larger host. Taking it from a very general, you know, in my own words perspective, which I put forth, but if you look at the Holy Quran, it says the same thing, right? That how many a small host has overcome a very large host. And what is the differentiating factor? It's not weapons and power and money and these kind of things. It's remaining steadfast, remaining on the correct path, being patient in the adversity, continuing to move forward, and fighting for a just cause. These small groups, you know, back in the day, were fighting a huge propaganda machinery which was being pushed by the Zionist powers and pro-Zionist lobbies. I mean, even today, these Zionist lobbies are humongous. Mm. And the fact that they're losing this propaganda war or this war of information is really, I think, one, humiliating for them, despite
all those resources that they have at their disposal.
I mean, yeah, the resources, the amount of global leaders that are in their pockets, you know.
The government supporting them.
The central banks that these people.
The intimidation, let's not forget that as well. The intimidation, the police forces are on their side. Mm-hmm. The system is actually on their side, and yet.
And despite all this, you find that this small group of people who were standing up for the just cause of Palestine, and the cause of Palestine itself is just, just go and read the history about it. They stood up, they stayed steadfast, and you have seen that the tide has turned. And now, more so than in solidarity of the Zionist state, the world is now in solidarity with the people of Palestine.
So coming back to Sheikh Ali, this idea of them having lost, essentially, the soft war, at least the previous battles, they've lost them. Are we saying that that's the main factor and cause in why they are censoring these predominantly Shia
media outlets? Of course, if you look at the enemy, they don't want the masses to, you know, wake up, right? That's one of the agendas of the mainstream media, to keep them in slumber, keep them sleeping, you know, just be irrelevant in this whole equation of, you know, truth versus falsehood and righteousness versus falsehood, the haq and batil. They want them to be just indifferent, right? Just focus on your own life, because it goes with their whole philosophy of life and the outlook they have towards the world and the life, where they say that you're a social animal who should only be concerned with your own needs and wants. You know, just stay there and no need. While when you look at Islam, for instance, or even human logic, right? We cannot be indifferent about a person dying on the street. We cannot be indifferent about, you know, a pregnant woman not reaching the hospital. We cannot be indifferent about a neighbor who is suffering, right?
It's this just is the true human definition of a social life.
Right.
Their definition is a contradiction, as you
right.
said.
So what these media outlets, you know, especially the ones who are banned, I don't know about all of them, because I haven't really studied all of them, but at least a few I know of, which were news reporting websites and satellite channels, they are banned because due to their activities and because what they were putting out there, and they were informing people, the masses were waking up, waking up against oppression, waking up against tyranny, waking up against these control that the Western hegemonic governments have had over them for decades, if not centuries, right? They were waking up to the reality of so-called liberal democracy, you know, the last 200 years phenomena, you know. It's just like a hoax, you know, where people were made to believe that you have a say, you have a right, you have... No, you don't have right, you don't have say, you don't have freedom of expression, you don't have freedom of speech in the West. You look at the academics who were not even Muslims, right? In some cases, they were Jewish people, right? These academics, their careers were ruined because they exposed the Western treachery and their plots, and especially the evil nature of the Zionist regime of Israel, right? Their academic careers were destroyed. Well, he's a teacher, he's a professor, right? Norman Finkelstein, for instance, you know, so on and so forth. There are too many of them, right? It's just one example.
And even people who weren't associated with the idea of Palestine, so to speak, but people like Julian Assange, who were just pointing out that, look, the flaws of the Western imperialistic system, even they're imprisoned.
Right. Now they're feeling vulnerable. Now the West is feeling vulnerable. They've put together something over the course of last 200 years, which is called the liberal democracy and its affiliated apparatus. They're feeling that it's vulnerable. People are not going to get tricked into and take it as at its face value. People are standing up, challenging that system, right? You saw, like, even with the so-called democracy, how people opposed the elected government and the Trump era and the transition to Biden. You saw that, right?
Fiasco. The storming of the Capitol is a huge historical event.
Right? So now they're seeing They're seeing that we are weak. They're seeing that the masses are waking up. They're seeing that it is not that we can just put out a multi-million dollar news reporting website or a TV channel or a satellite channel and people will be, the masses will be fooled that easily.
Or even that the movies that they make are going to completely, you know, put out their propaganda. Exactly. You know, you have superhero movies exactly. presenting the American military as the right. good guys and stuff. Right. So now people are even waking up to the cracks
now
in that.
The question is, connecting it back to your question, with all this in mind, who made it all happen? How did the masses wake up? It is because of projects like Press TV. It is because of projects like Al Alam. It is because of projects like Al Masira, right? These are the projects which are run by human beings, not by robots. Like their setups are being run by, you know, the machine built artificial intelligence based censorship and all that. No, these are human beings who are interacting with other people. And when that sentiment gets put out there in form of news, it has an effect on people. And because they were being effective in exposing the plots of the tyrants and the oppressive governments, they are silenced. Because that's all the West can do. They just know how to silence others, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes countries, sometimes governments, sometimes media channels, sometimes... Look at the crackdown that happened on social media profiles right after the martyrdom of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, right? People who had established profiles, 10 years, 12 years old profiles, they were wiped off their platforms.
Yes.
From Facebook, from Twitter, from YouTube, from Instagram, you know, so on and so forth. Now what we're seeing, this recent wave, is targeting those channels which are on satellite. So when it comes to social media, many of these channels of spreading the truth, they were removed. Now it's the turn of the satellite channels, Press TV and Al Masira and Al Alam and all that.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars, the moon. I join them all in praising you. Allah, oh Allah, 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 Allah. I feel alive and I feel so good. I feel so close to you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be continuing our discussion